the consequence of having only judicial review and not full merits review is that if the CMA claims or finds that a company's justification is not satisfactory, that it's not indispensable, that it doesn't, that it's not likely to benefit consumers, that's it. It's the end of the story.
Rishi Sunak has talked about making Britain a science and technology superpower. However, new legislation designed to promote competition in digital markets is raising concerns. The Digital Markets Bill will hand expansive new powers to the Competition and Markets Authority, which can intervene in digital markets without proving consumer harm and with limited accountability. Could this have some unintended consequences for innovation and investment? Welcome to the IEA podcast. My name is Matthew Lash, and I'm the IEA's Director of Public Policy and Communications. Each week, this podcast asks a tantalizing policy question. Today's question, what's wrong with digital markets regulation? To discuss, I'm excited to be joined by Dr. Lazar Radek, who is a senior scholar in the International Center for Law and Economics and an adjunct professor of law at IE University. Lazar and I have called for a new paper out this week, Digital Overload, How the Digital Markets Competition and Consumers Bills, Sweeping New Powers Threaten Britain's Digital Economy, co-published between the IEA and the ICLA. Welcome to the podcast, Lazar.
Thanks, Matt, and thanks for having me.
Before we get into some of the more specific details of what's going on in this bill, I wonder if you can give us a bit of background in terms of what you think the government's trying to achieve with this digital markets legislation, because obviously it's not UK specific, but there are these concerns about big tech and the way they operate.
Right. So there's obviously a global trend of tech regulation going on now. Many countries, including the European Union, South Africa, Australia, Canada, US have either implemented or are considering implementing ex-ante rules. And by ex-ante, I mean rules that create obligations that are sort of hard lines that companies have to abide by, which contrasts with ex-post, which is typically associated with competition law, where you first identify harm and then you intervene, right? As to what the UK is trying to achieve, It's not such a simple question, because not all these regimes are necessarily trying to achieve the same thing. Now, as far as the UK bill goes, on the face of it, what it's trying to achieve is more competition in markets and protection of consumers, especially in the digital part that we've commented on in our report, as you suggest. Now that's, you know, what it says in the box. Another question is what the government might really be wanting to achieve. And of course, whether it will lead to unintended consequences. In other words, whether it will achieve something substantively different.
Yeah, I mean, and there's a few places we can go from here. I mean, the first question is, you know, do you think that something like this is necessary? Is there a need for a kind of new approach to digital markets? Because I think the general argument goes something like, I don't know, there's lock-in effects, there's, you know, benefits of scale, which means the creation of these large multi-billion-dollar, pound, euro companies like Google and Meta and Amazon that have too much market power and are in some way hurting consumers as a result of exercising that power. And therefore, we can't just use the traditional tools of competition law, which are, as you've said, let's have a look at mergers and acquisitions very carefully. Let's interfere if there's been a anti-competitive, specifically anti-consumer, anti-competitive behavior, but rather what we need to do is create specific obligations on and we'll get into those, I guess, but on the companies.
Well, you know, assuming that the goal is to protect competition and to protect consumers, I'm not persuaded by the argument that digital markets are somehow unique enough to warrant a special far-reaching regime. If we're trying to achieve something else, if we're trying to distribute rents across the supply chain, if we're trying to promote certain competitors, which is not typically the same as protecting competition, right? Or if we're trying to punish big tech for something else, maybe for political reasons or for other transgressions, then something like this, you know, might be justified. But then again, it's not what it says in the box. It's not the government's stated goal or the goal of the bill. I think that traditional competition law has been effective and is still effective They're targeting anti-competitive behavior. We see this at European Union level, where there are several cases, several ongoing cases that incorporate theories of harm, such as self-preferencing, that are covered by the Digital Markets Act, which, just for context, is the EU's version of the DMCC, right? Or rather, the DMCC is the UK's version of the DMCC. So the fact that these cases exist suggests that some of this harm, self-preferencing, data portability or lack of data portability, can be addressed through competition loop tools. Now, a separate issue, although related, is whether it is too hard for the competition authority to prove harm, and whether it would actually prefer to have bright red line rules that allow it to simply prohibit conduct and not have to make its case. And that's something that we see both in the DMA and the DMCC that requires no proof of harm. So just to go back to your question, I don't think that it's necessary. I don't think that digital markets have the sort of idiosyncratic characteristics that require a separate, completely new approach if we're trying to achieve consumer protection and competition protection.
Yeah, and I guess an argument you could make is, in fact, that there is a lot of competition within the industry between the various technology companies, as well as smaller companies trying to come into their particular spaces. There's huge amounts spent on R&D. A lot of the products that we're receiving are at zero cost to the consumer. So it is, yeah. It is, you know, I suppose from the competition regulator's perspective, who they see some kind of harm going on, but they can't quite prove it in the traditional way. These kind of tools they feel are necessary. Let's get into a little bit of like how the DMCC actually is going to operate. So it starts off with what they call strategic market status designation. How does that process work?
Well, the process works that the bill supposedly only targets certain narrowly defined companies, right? And those are companies with SMS or strategic market status. The issue, one of my first gripes that we reflect in the paper, is that SMS and the thresholds to consider a company as having strategic market status are very broad. It involves quantitative threshold of income or revenue that is, I think, 1 billion, if I'm not mistaken, British pounds in the UK, or 25 billion worldwide. So
yes,
if a company, is that right?
Yes. Yeah.
Yeah. If a company satisfies those thresholds, it would qualify as a company with SMS. You know, as long as the company takes part in a digital activity that is linked to the United Kingdom and has a position of, and has a turnover of 1 billion in the UK or 25 billion globally, it can be targeted by the new regime. Now, the issues here are that the only real limiting factor is the turnover, because digital activity is defined extremely broadly as any activity in by which the company sells or buys goods or services through the internet. And a link to the United Kingdom simply means that the company has a significant number of customers or users in the UK. Now, significant is not defined. And as you can imagine, a lot of companies, I would say even most companies today, deliver some sort of service or product through the internet.
Yeah. So the original idea of this bill is it would be a small kind of narrow set of companies, yeah. the kind of companies that everyone thinks about in this context are things like Google and Meta and sure. Amazon. But in fact, basically, if you think of a supermarket is that has an online retail store or even uses, logistical supply chains that methods that involve digital tools could arguably have a digital presence. Banks obviously have digital presence. So the list goes on. And so that's the first element. The second element here is, even if the CMA only designates a relatively small number of companies, let's say they don't use their full discretion, at least initially, the fact is that the big digital companies are touching on so many different markets as well. So the mere fact of, we're only targeting small number of companies doesn't mean that they're not interfering in a large sectors of the economy.
Exactly. As you point out, even if they target, let's call them Gamma, Google, Amazon, Meta, Microsoft, and Apple. Let's say that even if they target them, these are very different companies, right? But the thresholds are so broad that potentially it could target about 520 companies right now, as of today. Now, we're relying on the CMA's, let's say, goodwill or good judgment that it will only sort of tailor it to a narrow subset of companies, but the tools are there. And if it wanted to, it could apply this regime to hundreds, more than 500 companies, right?
So let's think on to the next step here, which is once they are designated, what kind of things can the CMA do?
Once a company is designated, the CMA can impose a set of conduct requirements that prohibit or mandate certain conduct, okay? Now, obviously there are certain conditions, but as we shall see, these are again quite broad. So the CMA can pursue three objectives: fair dealing, open choices, and trust and transparency objectives. Again, fair dealing, open choices, it needs to be narrowed down, but the bill doesn't do that. And what the bill allows the CMA to do is whenever a company is engaging in any sort of activity that, say, bolsters its strategic significance, it can intervene with conduct requirements, which we will discuss later. The problem is that bolstering strategic significance because of how strategic significance is defined, could also encompass perfectly normal, efficient business behavior. Bolstering strategic significance. Strategic significance is defined as a position of significant size or scope. So basically anything that increases a company's size or scope, which could be internal growth, it could be, improved business efficiency, that could potentially bring it within the scope of the conduct requirements that the CMA can impose.
Yeah, I mean, in practical terms, just that requirement alone just seems quite extraordinary as a type of conduct requirement. When you think about it, that literally any investment in research and development could potentially increase their strategic significance. Any launching of new features or launching of a new product. I mean, the best example I can think of here is Meta having recently launched Threads as a competitor to Twitter/X.
Right.
I mean, that's obviously has the very strong potential to, if it is a successful product, to increase the quote-unquote strategic significance of Meta. But also, it seems pro-consumer at the same time, the fact that we're getting another platform where another alternative platform where we can engage and have discussions and in the process kind of have more consumer choice and more innovation. So it kind of almost seems like they kind of want to freeze the tech companies in place rather than allow the kind of dynamic competition that can across different sectors and different parts of the digital sector of the digital race.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And one of the issues that I have with the bill is that it obfuscates the difference between anti-competitive conduct and conduct that is pro-competitive and therefore bolsters the position of the targeted, the regulated company, right? It almost seems as if it's punishing innovation and product improvements, right? As you suggest.
So what's quite interesting about this is that the CMA can basically design bespoke interventions for each company. Not just conduct requirements, the other thing it can also do is pro-competition interventions. So it can do an even kind of pretty much any kind of intervention it likes under that broad, admittedly there's more protections in the sense there's more process to do a pro-competition intervention within the bill, but they can pretty much put any other kind of requirement on there. I mean, something that you were quite interested in discussing when we put together this publication is just the sense in which the bill doesn't really acknowledge the trade-offs involved here. So for example, I want to explain interoperability as one that the bill very much focuses on.
So the issue here, let me just go back one second and just explain to our listeners sort of one of the advantages that the DMCC might have compared to the DMA. So the DMA looks at only 10 core platform services, which are the kind of services or products that are targeted by the bill. It also incorporates a set of prohibitions and obligations that apply across the board, right? So as long as you're a gatekeeper, which is the equivalent of a company with strategic market significance in the EU. And as long as you have one of these core platform services, you have to abide by the full range of obligations. So they're not bespoke, they're not tailor-made. So one looks at the DMCC and says, okay, you know, it's reasonable that considering that the targeted companies are likely to have very different business models, as I indicated earlier, it is on the face of it a good thing that the DMCC allows the CMA to tailor-make.
It's meant to be, the government would say it's meant to be flexible and proportionate and right. less stringent. It could be, in theory at least, be less stringent than the EU's CMA, sure. which is quite prescriptive in terms of these are the companies and every company will have the same requirements.
Right. But the flip side of that is that it can be unpredictable and it can be more stringent, right? So that's just for context. And as for the kind of interventions that it contemplates, let's give us an example, interoperability. So interoperability would require two services, say two messaging services, to interoperate, to function with one another. So if you have, let's say, Meta, Facebook's Messenger, would have to be made interoperable with other messaging services, right? That could be Viber, Telegram, or it could be Apple's iMessage, right? So there are seeming advantages to this, which is that it allows new entrants into the market, so at least on the face of it, right? However, there is a problem with interoperability and data portability, which is that it could carry significant privacy and security risks. If companies are forced to allow interoperability with other services that have lower standards of safety and security, that could compromise the host app. A clear example is Apple. Apple's entire business model is built around a smaller, more controlled ecosystem that insists and bolsters privacy and security. And that's what the users of Apple expect, right? Now, if you force Apple's iOS to host other app stores other than Apple's app store, if you force iMessage to interoperate and to communicate with other messaging services, that could be compromised. There could be significant privacy and security risks. And my issue is not that interoperability is never a solution, is that the bill doesn't allow the consideration of these trade-offs that I've just mentioned to a sufficient extent.
Yeah, so the bill effectively gives the power to the CMA to put in all these requirements and doesn't really require the CMA to either, at least when it comes to the comes to the conduct requirements, to either prove that there is a harm that they're solving, that there's some issue for consumers already, or that their solution will be pro-consumer. Now, there is something in there, and in fact, some of the supporters of the bill say that this shouldn't even exist in itself, but there is something in the bill saying there's a consumer benefits exemption. Is that strong enough? Is that consumer benefits exemption strong enough to deal with any of these issues?
Yeah. Let me just make one thing clear. As you say, but in case our listeners are not aware, the CMA does not have to prove consumer harm to intervene. It is understood that consumer harm is already evident. It has been justified by the plethora of reports that the CMA has decided to follow because, you know, there's no unanimity. And as a consequence, it doesn't have to prove harm. Now, as you suggest, there is the theoretical possibility of an exemption if the company can prove that, for example, lack of interoperability benefits consumers, right? So there is that theoretical possibility, but there are two issues with this. First, it reverses the burden of proof. So it is the company that has to prove that its product design change is going to benefit consumers because it is presumed that it doesn't. If it, for example, doesn't allow data portability or interoperability, despite the significant risks that I've just mentioned, right? That is one thing. Another issue is that the threshold or the bar to clear is high. The company that is claiming a benefit has to prove that the change is necessary and proportionate and that consumer benefits are very likely. So
It goes even further than that. I mean, they have to prove it's indispensable, which is,
right.
I mean,
indispensable.
How do you prove anything is indispensable? I mean, of course, you could say privacy is dispensable. How do you say privacy is indispensable, that this particular feature or nature of our product is indispensable? Like it almost seems a laughably impossible standard to reach. Maybe over time it will be reached, I'm not sure, but it doesn't seem like it's designed to be used very much. And as you've said, it's an exemption that can only be used as part of an investigation into certain behavior. So basically they have to break the conduct requirement. Then when the CMA is investigating, they can reply and be like, oh, yeah, okay, we've broken the conduct requirement, but we think it's, you know, indispensable or proportionate. So they've already effectively admitted that they're not doing what they're meant to be doing, and then claim this very difficult to achieve exemption. It just seems like a total almost impossibility.
Yeah, it's probably a high bar. It depends on how it ends up being interpreted by the CMA. Although if you take it literally, you know, indispensability, likelihood, it is designed to be a high bar to clear. It's clearly not meant to be easy to satisfy. And, you know, that brings us to another topic, which is judicial review versus full merits review. This will not be fleshed out by the courts, right? It is going to depend on how the CMA interprets it because of a lack of full merits review.
Let's unpack that a little bit. So judicial review is, and I think it's a particularly kind of almost British phenomenon in the way it operates. It's got some very specific common law history. But it's this general idea that government administrative decisions can't be reviewed under a judicial review standard, can only be reviewed on the basis of whether or not they've followed the right process, not whether or not they've gotten the facts and underlying kind of logic right of the case. And the government effectively claims, you know, judicial review is justifiable in this case because the CMA will have the necessary knowledge and expertise to make the right decisions. So that effectively judicial review depends on the regulator really knowing what they're doing. And the only possible failures the regulator could make more or less relate to process issues, which does seem quite extraordinary. I mean, it basically means the regulator will have the power to decide who it regulates, will have the power to design whatever bespoke interventions it likes. And then if you're not happy, you have no, you know, ability to contest it on the claims that they are making, on the factual claims that they're making.
Exactly. And I, you know, just for the record, I struggle to understand how it can be argued that the CMA has the experience and knowledge when by default, this is a novel regulation. So experience from where? If they have experience from competition law, then why isn't competition law enough? Why do you need this? Just to go back to the example of proving consumer benefits and the exemption that is available to companies, the upshot and the consequence of having only judicial review and not full merits review is that if the CMA claims or finds that a company's justification is not satisfactory, that it's not indispensable, that is not likely to benefit consumers, that's it. It's the end of the story, right? The court doesn't check whether that is correct or not. The court only controls procedure, timing, evidence, and things like that, right? So I think that with a regime like this that is so far-reaching, that allows for so much discretion, not having full merits review is kind of insane.
Yeah, I mean, and I'm kind of interested to get a comparison here to how it is in other jurisdictions. So we've got a sense in which the CMA has been given a lot more discretion. How did the kind of review mechanisms work in the EU by comparison?
Well, generally in competition law, the courts do exercise full merits review, although it is different. There are two courts. There's the General Court and the ECJ, and they exercise different types of control. With the DMA also, there will be a more substantive form of review than with the DMCC, which leads me to ask, you know, why does the DMCC insist so much in having a narrow scope of review? I think that at the end of the day, both the enforcer, both the CMA, and the targeted companies, and potentially, you know, other companies that might be affected by the regulation, would benefit from a more substantive review, especially at an early stage for a regulation that is so new and so far-reaching, right?
Yeah, it's kind of an interesting point here where we're in this debate that the people who oppose a kind of full merits review and say judicial review is enough tend to be the supporters of the bill. And they're often kind of entities or companies that in some way potentially serve to benefit from the bill, that they feel like they could get a travel website feels like they could get a better deal in relation to their ranking on Google, or they're a news site who wants some kind of fair revenue from Google and Meta. They come to the conclusion, oh, we don't want full merits review. But there's no reason to think the CMA will be on their side in the end anyway.
Right.
I mean, if you have the kind of confidence in your argument and you think that the CMA might not always be with you, everyone should want full merits review to have the greater legal ability. And it's not like big tech will always win if there is full merits review.
Exactly. It's not like full merits review exclusively benefits, we can say, big tech, because we know who this bill targets, even though it might potentially, and as we said, it might potentially cover other companies that could tomorrow be in the crosshairs of the CMA, right? Like, the bill allows for that. Whether that is or isn't going to happen will probably depend on the discretion of the CMA. But also, those companies stand to benefit, right? And, you know, let me just maybe make a classical liberal argument. Then, when people tend to support discretionary powers or granting the government discretionary powers, they think that they're going to be used necessarily to their benefit. But that's not necessarily the case. And history proves that it's not necessarily the case. And this is an example of that. And I also think it marks a shift in British governance from the rule of law to government discretion. The whole bill is about allowing the CMA, therefore the government, to be the ultimate ordering power of the economy. And that is a significant departure.
Well, let's kind of see what we think and some of the implications could be here of basically the government handing all this regulatory power to the CMA, having relatively weak review standards. We kind of open this discussion about Rishi Sunak's science and technology superpower. What does this mean for innovation and investment?
I mean, you know, let's say the best case scenario, the CMA uses its powers wisely. It only targets market failures. It tailors its interventions perfectly to those instances in which there is an abuse of market power, where there's bottlenecks and that harm consumers and innovation, right? Okay. But what if it doesn't? What if, you know, the CMA uses its broad powers and chills behavior that is pro-competitive and discourages behavior from which consumers could benefit, right? Moreover, what if the approach of the CMA and different iterations of the CMA change over the years? It will create significant unpredictability for companies who perhaps, understandably, instead of launching a new feature or rolling out a new feature in the UK, you'll decide not to or will think twice. We saw with Threads that there was a significant concern that the app wasn't launched in the EU because of the threat of the Digital Markets Act, which is, as I said, the EU's version of the DMCC. Now, we could see something similar happen in the UK, and to the extent that the DMCC goes arguably even further, I think that those effects could be compounded, could be worse. So to answer your question, paradoxically, a decrease in what consumers get, a decrease in consumer choice, a decrease in features, and a decrease in innovation.
Indeed, and I think we kind of saw a recent case of this, of the potential risk for the UK and the perception of the UK around the Microsoft Activision merger, that this is a case where the CMA ended up becoming the only competition authority to reject this deal that was ultimately approved by a US court, by the EU and dozen other countries. And in response to that, there was some quite serious concern and some actually almost surprisingly harsh words from Brad Smith and Microsoft, saying, you know, this uncertainty created by the CMA makes us not want to do business in the UK and makes us prefer to do business in the EU. And I just noticed as we were recording this podcast today on Friday, the 22nd of September, the CMA has just approved a modified version of the merger, so that the CMA is already kind of being forced, and I would say kind of embarrassingly. I mean, they're claiming it's a different deal, and indeed the conditions are slightly different, although it's fundamentally still the same prospect of this merger. And now the CMA's more or less changed their mind on this, but in the process, I think have embarrassed themselves and made, I suppose, a lot less certainty for investors going into the UK in the digital space.
Yeah. Let me just put in a good word for the CMA, because I don't intend to vilify them at all. I think that, you know, part of the, I don't want to say tragedy, that's too big of a word, but I guess that what bothers me about this is that the UK's regulators have traditionally had the reputation of being leaders in their field and having a moderate, well thought out, fleshed out approach to regulation, right? Where they would target market failures with a laser focus, but allow and encourage pro-competitive behavior that would ultimately also benefit the competitiveness of the British economy, right? And that's something laudable. I'm not against regulation per se, right? What I am against, or what I warn against, is knee-jerk reactions that over-regulate and strangle the world's most innovative companies, despite what some might say, with red tape. Right. And I think that the CMA has to go back to the drawing board and make some changes, and perhaps go back.
It says for the government to make the changes to legislation, although I think the CMA does support.
Right. Yeah. Because in Europe, the commission is in charge of the legislative proposal and so on. So, yeah, for the government to make those changes, which we make some recommendations in our paper. We can go through that. But what I'm saying is, you know, the CMA and Britain have a tradition in reasonable economic regulation. And there is no need to depart from that now, just because the UK is seeing that some countries are making changes or making noise and so on. There's no need for that sort of drastic response.
Well, indeed, we make some recommendations at the end of our paper in relation to moving to that full merit standard, as well as ensuring better protections and checks for consumer requirements, check for consumer benefits before intervening. Although I think we're coming to time, so I might leave it there. Thank you so much for joining the IA podcast, Dr. Lazar Radek of the ICLE, the International Centre for Law and Economics. For those who do want to learn more about this topic and want to read the full set of recommendations, I do encourage you to visit either the IEA website or the ICLE website, and you can download our paper called Digital Overload. If you are enjoying this podcast, please do subscribe on your chosen podcast provider, and look forward to speaking to you again next week.